Amanda, remember that time a teacher became one of the most important people in U.S. government?
Hello, and welcome to Remember That Time, an historical podcast. I'm your host, Amanda Webb.
And I'm your host, Anna Webb, and this is a podcast where two sisters totally geek out about all their favorite moments in history. And we're back.
Here we are.
I'm sorry for the delay, everyone.
The vid came for Anna.
Yeah, I'm still coughing a little. So, okay, if the flow of the episode sounds a little bit different, it's because Amanda had to cut out all of my coughs.
Yeah.
Much better than I was last week. If I would have tried to do, I mean, it wasn't possible. I couldn't get through two sentences without coughing Hacking. For like 30 seconds.
Right.
So I'm still coughing a little, but I'm fine. Yeah. That was wild. We recorded the last episode and my throat was really hurting. And I was like, oh, I was so sure it was a sinus. I think I said on the recording, the sinus thing or whatever. And then later that day, I tested positive for COVID for the first time. So it was rough. It was terrible. I'm really grateful that I was vaccinated because with as bad as it was, I can't imagine how much worse it would have been without the like several layers of protection that I had. So, but man. I appreciate everyone's patience while I got better.
So, despite our longer month of February, we still had to push our last Black History Month episode back, but that's all right.
Ain't no big. So, it is March, but we're continuing our Black History Month episodes. Didn't want to miss out on one. And you know what? Why should Black History Month have to end in the shortest month of the year? That's crazy.
Truly. Truly.
Even when it's longer, it's still the shortest month.
I told my students today the fun fact that if we had 13 months, every month would be an even amount of days and we'd never have to have a leap year, and they didn't know what to do with that information.
Yeah. Time is made up.
Yeah, it's all fake. Oh, when I tell the kids about time zones, oh my God, they freak out. It's awesome. They really don't know what to do with that information. It's great. When I tell, like, I tell them that daylight savings is made up, and they're like, "What? Yeah. What do you mean? What do you mean?" And I was like, "Yeah,
well,
think about it.
Why would we do that? Why would we ever do that? For what reason?
Yep.
Because someone decided we should. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Well, here we are. Mm-hmm. And would you like a quick drink update?
Of course.
You already know what I'm drinking because you saw it before, but I'm having a glass of wine because I deserve it.
So true.
And also I have water because I'm coughing.
You have to provide for the body and the soul.
Exactly.
I'm drinking water all day, every day.
Perfect.
Keeps me hearty.
Wow. Okay. We're off to an interesting start in this one.
Truly.
Okay, so today we are going to learn about Mary McLeod Bethune. And I didn't know that much about her. I knew the name, but the reason I really decided I wanted to research it more was actually because I saw it in a TikTok. So I want to give a shout out to that TikToker who doesn't need a shout out because he has way more followers than listeners of this podcast. But his username is @blackout_ at the end. And his display name is Dr. Andre 3001, which is hilarious.
That's iconic.
And he did a whole series of like badass black history is what I think he called it. I know we don't curse on this, but that's what
that's valid. That's valid.
And his video about Mary popped up and I was like, wow, she's really interesting. And there's so much I didn't know. So we're going to learn about her today.
Let's do it.
And we're doing two like suffragette queens.
Love that. So, love that.
Okay. So Mary Jane McLeod is born July 10th, 1875 in Maysville, South Carolina. And she is born on a rice and cotton farm. And she is the 15th of 17 children.
Oh my good Lord.
It's a lot of children.
Bless.
In my opinion.
Bless.
But we are grateful we had Mary. So
truly.
Her parents are Sam and Patsy McLeod, and they are both formerly enslaved people. So many of her older siblings were born into slavery.
Sure. But by the time she's born, yeah.
Right. So after the Civil War, her mom actually continues to work for their former owner, but is
a lot of
paid.
People did. Yeah.
Yeah. Until she can buy land. So the family does end up buying their own farm where they grow cotton. Mm-hmm. And her father farms, before they buy their own land, her father farms on nearby land they called the homestead. So he continued to work as a farmer.
It's a very common story that I feel like we don't really hear as much anymore.
What other opportunities were there?
Very much what happened to a lot of people, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, they were just forced to be paid. Not paid well, but paid
no,
at all.
No.
So.
And with 17 children, I mean, come on. Yeah. Some of them
were
obviously
out of the house
grown
by then.
Up,
yeah.
But still. So when she's young, Mary also does farming. She farms for cotton, and she also will help her mom. Her mother would, like, do the washing for white folks, and she would help her to deliver the washing to their homes. And I read a little thing that was, like, she would kind of poke around in the, like, white kids' bedrooms, and she would get really interested in the books, and she wanted to read the books. And some white kid apparently told her, like, you can't read. And she was like, okay, well, I will. So...
Love that.
She was like, okay, and I will. So
she said, oh, I'll do it out of spite now. It's right. The greatest motivator.
Yeah. So she attends the one-room black schoolhouse in town in Maysville called Trinity Mission School. And it is run by the Presbyterian Board of Missions of Freedmen. And that's important because indeed. It's going to be really influential on her and what she wants to do with her life. She walks 5 miles each day to school.
Typical.
And she's the only child in her family to attend school. So she would also sometimes come home and teach her other family members what she was learning.
Wow.
Her teacher, Emma Jane Wilson, becomes a big influence on her and kind of becomes a mentor. And Emma helps Mary get into Scotia Seminary, which is a boarding school in North Carolina, and she helps her to get a scholarship there because Emma had also attended that school. So Mary graduates from Scotia Seminary in 1894, and then she goes on to attend Dwight Moody's Institute for Home and Foreign Missions in Chicago.
That sounds very Mormon.
It's Presbyterian still.
But doesn't it sound so Mormon?
Well, mission is a very
and
Mormon
also something
term.
Something about the name Dwight Moody. That sounds like a fake person. Dwight Moody's Institute for Home and Foreign Missions. It's so made up. That sounds so made up. I love it.
So she attends this school and she hopes to become a missionary in Africa. That's what she wants to do with her life. But the issue is that there are no churches who are willing to sponsor her.
Well, because why would they want a black person to preach the good word to all of the other black people?
They can't spread white supremacy that way.
They don't get to be the white savior that way.
Exactly, 100%. So instead, she decides to become a teacher. She works as a teacher briefly at her former elementary school in Sumter County. And then in 1896... she starts teaching at the Haynes Normal and Industrial Institute in Augusta, Georgia.
We really used to just be naming schools whatever, huh?
Yeah, a normal school is a school where someone goes to basically learn to become a teacher.
Yeah.
I don't know why, though.
Me either, but I think it's hilarious.
I agree. And that school is also part of a Presbyterian mission organized by a bunch of northern congregations.
Okay.
So, still with that heavy influence there. After about a year at Haynes, she's transferred by the Presbyterian Mission, because again, they run all these schools, so they can kind of decide where people go, to the Kendall Institute in Sumter, South Carolina. And while she's teaching there, she meets another teacher named Albertus Bethune, and they get married, and they have a son together in 1899. And then they move to Savannah, Georgia, and she does some social work there for a little while. And then they move to Florida because they're persuaded to go there by another Presbyterian minister who kind of says they need someone like you in this area. So they go to Palatka, I think is how you say it. Palatka, Florida. I'm not sure about that pronunciation. And they, Palatka, she goes, maybe. Yeah, maybe Palatka. That sounds more right to me, but I don't know why. they go there and she runs a mission school there. And she also starts doing outreach to prisoners while they're there, which I found interesting. She works for the local church. She also sells insurance, which we're going to come back to.
Why not? Do you know the best insurance? Jesus Christ our Lord. Ain't no better insurance than the love of Jesus Christ. Deepest apologies.
Suck on a Capri Sun and know this is God's plan.
Indeed.
Oh my God, that was, oh, ouch. Okay.
That's basically what the Mormons do.
Yeah, you keep bringing up the Mormons. They're not part of this story.
But we talked about the Mormons earlier, and then we were talking about selling life insurance, and then I thought about door-to-door life insurance salesmen.
I understand. And then I thought about the Mormons. It's just funny to me that you keep bringing them up, but they're not part of the story at all.
They're everywhere, always.
So, Albertus, her husband, leaves the family in the early 1900s. I saw conflicting years. Like, one said 1904, one said 1907. Either way, he leaves them. And they never officially divorce, but he moves back to South Carolina, and eventually he dies of tuberculosis.
Tuberculosis.
So not that long after. He dies in 1918, so it's not that long after he leaves them.
Sure.
So.
TV. You old so-and-so.
But at least she wasn't stuck, like, married to this man.
Yeah.
You know. So, Mary becomes really determined to open her own school because she needs to provide for her son. And also, it's just, like, her passion. She wants to do it. So, she moves to Daytona to open the school because there are a lot of tourists coming into Daytona at this time. So she's like, great, big population. There's going to be some opportunities.
A growing city. Yeah.
Right. So, in October of 1904, she rents a small house for $11 a month.
I wish.
I know, right? She makes benches and desks from, like, crates and other items she finds and gets through charities. And she starts the Educational and Industrial Training School for Negro Girls. And she initially has 6 students. She's got 5 girls and then her son, Albert. He goes to school there, too. So it is a girls' school, but she doesn't really stick too
harshly to that.
Yeah, but the mission is to educate black girls. Sure. So that's the main focus.
The mission is to educate black girls. And if anybody else has a brother who needs an education, bring him along. Yeah.
Yeah. Or a little white girl who doesn't have the resources. She would welcome them, too.
Sure.
The school borders the dump in Daytona. So she and parents of the students, sorry, our Google doesn't call. Do it. I just moved my hand a certain way that kind of looked like a thumbs up, or maybe I did one and didn't realize it. And a little thumbs up bubble appeared.
Mine will not do it.
It doesn't do it on my work calls either. I don't know mine why it's happening. It. I've never set it to do a thumbs up, but I've never this said is it to do that.
Homophobic. I want to do a little bit, and Google refuses.
And I can't tell you if it's a setting, because I have never touched anything like that. I don't know what's going on. Man.
It's just the ADHD in this episode is strong.
Yeah. Okay, So the school borders the dump in Daytona.
Yes.
So Mary and the students and the parents and the church members, they raise a bunch of money by making sweet potato pies and ice cream and fried fish and selling it to the crews at the dump. So that's how they first start like fundraising for the school.
That's a good idea.
Kind of cool. The kids also make ink for their pens from elderberry juice, pencils from burned wood. So they're like making all their own stuff for the most part. They're
asking who's going to give you money for supplies.
Yeah. Well, they do. They get some furniture like from local businesses, and they get donations from like local Black churches. They also get a lot of volunteer labor from those churches. And within the first year, she is teaching over 30 girls at the school, which is really cool. And Mary knows how to fundraise. I'll tell you what. She knows how to get that money. And you know
if
how?
She learned nothing else at seminary, learned how to get that cash.
That is right. And you know how? It's because she knows to target the white folks.
Yeah.
And she knows how to do it.
She said, I will play off of that white guilt.
100%. So she starts going after like wealthy white organizations. Like the Ladies Palmetto Club. She starts inviting influential white men to sit on her board of trustees. So they feel like they've got a say. She gets James Gamble of P&G, which is wild to me.
Wow.
And Ransom Eli Olds of Oldsmobile.
Oh my gosh.
And Thomas White of White Sewing Machines.
Dang.
She meets Booker T. Washington at some event, I don't remember, and he visits the school. And if you know about Booker T. Washington, we should do an episode on him for sure. But he created the Tuskegee Institute. Mm-hmm. He knew how to run a school, and he knew how to go after the white funders as well. And he comes to the school, and he encourages her, and he gives her some more, you know, encouragement on how to do that. They have a very rigorous curriculum. The girls get up at 5:30 a.m. for Bible study.
Oh.
And then they've got classes all day. They've got like home economics and industrial skills and dressmaking and cooking. And then, of course, you know, other normal subjects that any kid should learn.
Reading, writing, arithmetic.
Exactly. And then their day doesn't end till like 9 p.m.
She said, if I'm going to waste my time talking to white men, you will be here all day long.
That's exactly right.
She said, we will use their money.
Yeah, she said, we're going to use every bit of that money.
Yes, indeed.
And she starts introducing like high school level math and English and foreign languages so she can keep educating them as they grow. Mm-hmm. She travels around a lot to fundraise. She gets a donation of $62,000 from John D. Rockefeller.
Wow, what a guy.
And at some point, she makes very good friends with the Roosevelts.
That tracks to me, just knowing the Roosevelts.
Yeah, and that is huge in her life.
It makes sense to me that Eleanor would love this woman.
She and Eleanor become, like, best friends.
I love that. I love Eleanor Roosevelt. They are thick as
thieves, I'll tell you
We've done an episode on Eleanor Roosevelt because she is just my favorite.
Yeah. So that gives her a huge network, mm-hmm. right? Which is obviously beneficial. And then in 1931, the Methodist Church helps with a merger of her school and the Boys Cookman Institute.
Huh.
And this forms the Bethune-Cookman College, which is still in operations. It's an HBCU.
That's amazing.
And it becomes a co-educational junior college, and she becomes the first president.
Wow.
It issues its first degrees in 1943, so.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool.
You know, the Methodists and the Presbyterians have historically been besties.
Yeah. So, she also makes the school's library accessible to the public, and it becomes Florida's first free library accessible to Black Floridians.
That's amazing. Which is
so cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
This woman's my hero.
Speaking of the Methodist Church, she becomes a member.
Oh, see, they're besties.
Uh-huh.
Next door neighbors our whole lives.
Right. But the Methodist Church is still segregated in the South.
Yes, that's right.
So there are basically two organizations within the Methodist, denomination operating separately.
The Methodists and the Methodist Episcopal, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And Mary is really intent on fixing this.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes a really prominent member in the primarily Black Florida Conference.
Huh.
And she works really hard to integrate the mostly white Methodist Episcopal,
Okay, that's what church. I thought, the ME. Yeah.
And she actually initially protests the plans for integration because their plan was basically like separate but equal, kind of.
And she said,
that's not how we're going to do it. So she becomes a big...
We are all equal in the eyes of the Lord. Thank you so much.
And we can worship together. Yeah, so she becomes a big part of that movement.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
This was also so interesting. This is another thing I just, like, did not know about her. So in the early 1900s, Daytona Beach does not have a hospital that will serve Black patients.
Which is insane to me, but, But
one of her students gets, like, really bad appendicitis, and none of the hospitals will take her, and Mary like pitches a fit. She's like, you're going to take this girl. And eventually the hospital does, but she goes to visit this student, and the student is being so badly mistreated. Like, she's being put in a separate building. Mary has to go in through like the service entrance to see her, and it, obviously that's not uncommon, but Mary is incensed by it, of course.
Uh-huh.
As you should be. So she decides she's going to do something about it, because that's Mary. She takes action. And she finds a cabin near the school, and she gets a bunch of people to help her raise money. And she buys it for $5,000. And in 1911, she opens the first Black hospital in Daytona, Florida.
Why not? Why not? You go, girl.
It starts with 2 beds, and then within a few years, it has 20.
It's amazing.
She has both white and Black physicians working there.
In the backyard of my church? Oh, it's our hospital.
Yeah. And her student nurses start working there.
That's amazing.
Well.
That's amazing. Yeah.
There was like an explosion at a nearby construction site, and this hospital took all of the injured Black workers.
Wow.
They were also really instrumental in their work during the 1918 influenza outbreak, because the main hospital was full, and they actually
not taking Black patients.
Yeah, and they actually ended up having to use the school auditorium for overflow.
Wow.
Yeah, and so a lot of her students helped with that as well. So obviously, Mary is a huge activist, and she takes part in lots of different organizations. She helps voter registration drives after women get the right to vote in 1920,
mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, a big risk because she's a Black woman, in general. And then in 1924, she's elected president of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. And she had served as the president of the Florida chapter starting in 1917, and then she became president of the National Association. This was really interesting. So that organization, the NACW, buys a property at 1318 Vermont Avenue in Washington, D.C., and it becomes the first Black-controlled organization with headquarters in the Capitol.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and she leads the organization there. She also serves as the president of the Southeastern Federation of Colored Women's Clubs from 1920 to 1925. And this is an organization that helps improve opportunities for Black women. And this organization really intends to reach out to all Southern women, but particularly white women, to get them to support and unite with Black women and help them to gain more rights.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we all know through the history of this country, you gotta get the white folks on your side or nothing will happen, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. The white women, specifically, hold a frightening amount of power.
Well, this is why we talk about why your feminism has to be intersectional.
Yep.
But that's a different discussion for a different day,
reason,
sort of.
The reason we remember the Civil War the way we do is the fault of white women, so,
you know. Yes, 100%, daughters of the American Revolution, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Those types of people, yeah. So suffrage is a real sticking point here because the white women have the right to vote, but they don't want to go so far as to let the black women vote, though. Mm-hmm. So it's a big issue. And the white women at the conference actually try to strike down a resolution on black suffrage. And the organization responds by issuing a pamphlet called Southern Negro Women and Race Cooperation. And it's got all of their demands in it, basically. Conditions in domestic service, child welfare, conditions of travel, education, lynching, which is still a big issue at this time, the press, voting rights, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, we all know eventually they are granted suffrage. And the group then goes on to help register a lot of black women to vote, of course, after that constitutional amendment passes. In 1928, she's invited to attend the child welfare conference called by the then president Calvin Coolidge. In 1930, President Herbert Hoover appoints her to the White House Conference on Child Health.
Wow.
In 1935, she is a founder of the National Council of Negro Women in New York City. This brings together representatives of 28 different organizations to work to improve the lives of black women in their community. So all these different organizations spread out, she said, we got to get on the same page, basically, you know? Mm-hmm. And in 1938, this organization, the NCNW, hosts the White House Conference on Negro Women and Children. And then during World War II, I found this so interesting. The NCNW gets approval for black women to be commissioned as officers in the Women's Army Corps.
Huh.
And she, like, serves as a, yeah, she serves as a political appointee and the special assistant to the Secretary of War.
That's a big deal.
Massive. In 1936, she becomes a full-time staffer for the National Youth Administration, which is a federal agency that Roosevelt created during his Works Progress Administration.
That's one of those. Whole thing. It's the alphabet soup of the New Deal. That's how my kids remember it.
That's so great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. After she lobbies for minority involvement in the agency, she becomes a staffer there. And like we said before, she is a very good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Much love, Eleanor Roosevelt.
And so in 1936, as part of this organization, she becomes the highest ranking African-American woman in government. Franklin Roosevelt names her Director of Negro Affairs for the NYA. So, and she stays in that position until 1944.
It's amazing.
Yeah, huge.
I'm obsessed with that.
So she manages the funds of the NYA to help black students through school-based programs.
Because she's very good at that.
100%, yeah. She's the only black agent of the NYA who is a financial manager. So she's the only one who has any control over any of the money.
Wow.
Which is really interesting. She ensures that black colleges participate in the civilian pilot training program, which then graduates some of the first ever black pilots, which is so interesting. She also advocates for the appointment of black NYA officials to different positions of political power. So she's pulling up other black folks in the organization.
Good for her.
And she and her administrative assistants serve as liaisons between the National Division of Negro Affairs and the NYA agencies on state and local levels. And they help to get better job and salary opportunities for black people across the country.
Nice.
And during her time at the NYA, she pushes for federal officials to approve a program of consumer education for Black folks and a foundation for Black disabled children.
Huh.
Which is really cool.
Nice.
It's like she thinks of everything that not, that some people get so focused in on one thing, you know?
Yeah, but she covers a very broad spectrum of issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is so difficult for a human being to do.
Yeah, right? Especially with, like, that's a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a huge movement to have your hands and brain and all these different parts of it is really impressive. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about her friendship with Eleanor. So
besties.
Besties. They become friends. And at the Southern Conference on Human Welfare in 1938, which is in Birmingham, Alabama, Eleanor Roosevelt requests a seat next to Mary, despite the fact that the state has segregation laws.
Eleanor Roosevelt said, I'm bigger than this state.
That's exactly right. She often refers to Mary as, quote, her closest friend in her age group, which I thought was, like, very cute. And Mary would often tell, like, she would talk to Black voters about the things that the Roosevelts were doing in their favor.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of in the reverse of that, she had their ear. So she could take all of the concerns of Black voters directly mm-hmm. to them.
Yeah.
And so she had this huge access to the White House because she was such good friends with Eleanor.
That's amazing. I'm obsessed with the Roosevelt administration.
It's so interesting.
So interesting.
Yeah. So much happens. Like,
so much happens. Well, he was president for a bajillion years, so.
Yeah, right?
Man served four terms.
Things were different then.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
That law didn't exist yet.
Right, exactly. That's what I meant. So she uses her access to the White House to form a coalition of leaders from Black organizations, and she calls it the Federal Council of Negro Affairs, and this becomes known as the, like, unofficially known as the Black Cabinet.
I've heard of the Black Cabinet before. Yeah,
you'll often hear people talking about Roosevelt's quote-unquote Black Cabinet.
Black Cabinet.
It was this, and she created it, basically.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it serves as an advisory board, basically, to the Roosevelt administration. And has a lot of talented people in it, mostly Black men, because
that was mostly
too many women in.
If they were in government at all at that point, it was mostly men.
Despite the fact that the woman was coming up with
it, yeah, whatever. Typical.
but it's the first collective of Black people working in higher positions in government.
So cool.
She also plays a really, really big role in the transition of Black voters from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party.
Wow. That's a big deal.
The party switch kind of happened because
that is
the
a
Republican
big
Party,
deal.
Yep, is the quote-unquote party of Lincoln, but we've got this big shift in, we call it the party switch in America. Mm-hmm. If you're not from here, it might not be as familiar to you.
Liberal policy shifts away from the Republicans into the
Democrats.
Like around the Great Depression time.
Exactly.
Because FDR was in office and he was putting through all of these very liberal policies.
Social programs.
And it was this huge, huge deal.
Yeah.
Huge deal to lose the Black vote from the Republican Party.
And she plays a really, really big role in getting the Black vote to switch.
Crazy. That is so wild.
Okay, in 1937, she organizes a conference on the problems of the Negro and Negro youth. And this is a big push to end lynching and discrimination, other forms of discrimination. In 1940, she becomes vice president of the NAACP.
Oh my gosh.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored Persons or Colored People. I don't really say colored people anymore, but that's what the organization is still called.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Typically call it the NAACP.
NAACP, yep.
A position that she holds it for the rest of her life.
That's amazing.
I know.
Vice president of the NAACP in the 1940s is like,
I know.
A big deal.
All of this is a big deal.
I know. That's crazy.
Also in the 1940s, she uses her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt to secure luxury travel buses for Eddie Durham's All-Star Girls Orchestra, which is an all-African-American, all-woman swing band. Which
that's
is
delightful.
So cool.
That's what everybody should be using their political power for,
yeah,
frankly.
Right? How about these girlies?
Yeah, I love that.
She also regularly writes for big African American newspapers, the Pittsburgh Courier, and the Chicago Defender.
Oh, yeah.
She co-founds the United Negro College Fund, the UNCF, which is still in operation, on April 25th, 1944, along with William J. Trent and Frederick D. Patterson. If you don't know what the program is, it gives scholarships and mentorships and job opportunities to African Americans and other minority groups that go to the 37 HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities.
That's wild.
She, in 1945, she is appointed by President Harry S. Truman to be the only woman of color at the founding conference of the United Nations.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Every time you think there's not going to be another thing.
And homegirl is, like, getting up there in years at this point, too.
Yeah.
Like.
But she was serving up until the end of her life.
That's wild.
Okay, well, we're not done. In 1949, she becomes the first woman to receive the National Order of Honor and Merit, which is the highest award possible in Haiti.
Huh.
I thought that was really cool.
Fascinating.
She serves as the U.S. emissary to the induction of President William V.S. Tubman of Liberia in 1949. Hmm. So she is, like, the representative of the U.S. at this major, like, historical event. I thought this was so funny. She carries a cane, but not because she has mobility, because she needs it for mobility support, just for effect.
I love that.
Because she said it gave her, quote, swank.
Obsessed. Obsessed with that. She said the walk is half of it.
Personality. Yeah.
The walk is half of it.
That, well, yeah, 100%. She's also a teetotaler, which, if you don't know what that is,
a teetotaler.
It's someone who really wants everybody to abstain from alcohol. She really believes in temperance for African Americans.
Well, she was Methodist, so.
Yeah, she's actually a little judgy about it, but you know what? I think she's allowed to be judgy about this one thing, right?
Listen, man, we wouldn't have Welch's grape juice were it not for those Methodists.
That's so true.
So, you know, we're really out here.
I have finished many a Welch's grape juice bottle to finish the elements after communion.
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Every time I tell people that fun fact, they're like, oh my God.
That had to come from somewhere.
Yeah. Yep.
So altogether, she serves as an advisor to 5 U.S. presidents.
Oh my God, she's like the queen.
Yeah. She's all about self-sufficiency, obviously.
Yeah.
She invests in several businesses, including the Pittsburgh Courier, previously mentioned. And lots of other life insurance companies.
Because she knows the best life insurance.
Is one of the founders of Central Life Insurance of Florida.
What?
I told you we'd come back to it.
Oh my God, that's funny. That's so funny.
This was also really interesting. So because of segregation in Florida, black folks were not allowed to visit the beach.
Uh-huh.
So what does she do? She gets other business owners together and they start investing and purchasing parts of Paradise Beach, a 2-mile stretch.
Work.
And they also start buying up the surrounding properties and selling them to black families.
I'm obsessed with that.
And
that.
They also allow white families to come in to the beach.
Sure.
It's not like they tell them, and now you can't come here. It's just,
right.
We are also here now. And eventually, Paradise Beach is named Bethune-Volusia Beach in her honor. She ends up owning 25% of the Welricha Motel in Daytona. So she owns a beach resort, part of a beach resort, too.
Hilarious.
Wild.
She said, oh, and another problem?
Exactly.
We don't have school? Got it. We don't have
a
hospital?
She's trying to fix Florida.
Got it.
Which is a
big
job.
We can't go to the beach? Got it. Like,
she was really trying to fix Florida, which is still a big job.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. God bless her.
Yeah. So Mary passes away on May 18th, 1955 of a heart attack.
Wow.
She's buried on the grounds of Bethune-Cookman University. You can go and see her grave there.
That's amazing.
And then just some you know, kind of post-mortem things about her. In 1973, she's inducted into the National Women's Hall of Fame. I got a lot of info. Yeah, I got a lot of info from their website for this.
Both of our Black History Month
I know
people this That's year are National Women Hall of Famers. I love Amazing. That.
On July 10th, 1974, which was the anniversary of her, it would have been her 99th birthday, the Mary McLeod Bethune Memorial by artist Robert Burks is erected in her honor in Lincoln Park in Washington, D.C. And this is interesting because it's the first monument honoring an African American or a woman to be installed in a public park in Washington, D.C.
Whoa. That's very cool.
Yeah. In 1985, she gets a postage stamp.
Yes. We love a stamp.
Yes. In 1994, the National Park Service acquires her last residence, which is the NACW Council House that I mentioned earlier.
Oh, wow.
And it is now called the Mary McLeod Bethune Council House, National Historic Site. So it is an official historic site.
Very cool.
Very cool. In 2018, the legislature of Florida designates her as the subject of one of Florida's two statues in the National Statuary Hall collection.
Oh, cool.
Replacing Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith.
Oh, that rules.
Yeah.
I'm so interested in the National Statuary Hall.
Well, get ready, because we got another fact about a National Statuary Hall.
Oh,
because
boy.
On July 13th, 2022, she becomes the first African-American to be represented with a state statue in the National Statuary Hall collection at the U.S. Capitol.
That's wild to me.
I know.
That's insane. In 2022?
I know.
That's insane.
But if anybody deserves to be the first, it's her.
Oh,
totally.
But
it should have happened a long time ago.
That's wild.
Yeah.
What? There are so many. That's wild.
I know. That's Mary.
That's. I loved that. I'm obsessed with her.
I knew you would.
That's amazing.
There's just so much about her. And she had her hand in so many things. And I, like, again, I had heard her name before, but. That video came up on my TikTok.
I think I had only heard her name in relation to Eleanor Roosevelt. Like,
probably,
I think that's
yeah.
why I knew the name. Like, I knew that this woman was Eleanor Roosevelt's friend. Sure, very famously, she is friends with Eleanor Roosevelt.
But that video popped up on my TikTok, and he was talking about she was the highest ranking, you know, African-American woman in government, and she ran the black cabinet. And I was like, what? Why don't I know any of this? Because I know why. Because we're not taught about that sort of thing in school. But I was just like, man, she sounds so interesting. So
very cool.
Had to look her up and do some research. I'm glad I did because she was so fun to learn about. There are definitely other people in his series that I saved. I was like, I'm going to have to come back to some of those. So I would recommend going to his TikTok and watching some of those videos. Because they'll be succinct, obviously, but can lead you into more research.
Yeah. This is a very cool episode. She was fascinating.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I knew that you would like her.
Yeah.
Especially as soon as I read the Eleanor Roosevelt thing, I was like, oh boy, Amanda's going to love this.
I love Eleanor Roosevelt. We just finished talking about World War II in my class, so we're like just leaving FDR. And every time I got to talk about Eleanor Roosevelt, I would, because I love her.
Fascinating person.
She's my fave.
Yeah, she ruled pretty hard.
Yeah, this was very cool.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. And again, thank you everybody for being patient. I hope that the flow of this one isn't too weird. I did have to stop and cough many times.
Many times.
I just had to do it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the end of our Black History Month episodes. We are into March now, which is Women's History Month, and maybe we'll do some episodes themed around about that. But honestly, We haven't committed to that lately, just because we talk about a lot of women on this. So I don't think we need that special.
We bounce around a lot. Yeah.
We do, yeah. So we'll see. I don't know what's next. Obviously, our schedule's a little different now because we only push back 1 week instead of to when our next episode would normally be. But we'll figure it out.
We'll pivot.
It happens. Yeah. So don't know what the next one's going to be, but hopefully by then I'll be done coughing. We'll see.
Who's to say?
Who's to say? Hard to know, because I would have hoped I would have been done by now, but here we are.
Here we are.
Hey, listen, quick PSA, get vaccinated. For
truly.
I haven't done it yet. I don't know what you're doing. I mean, seriously, I don't know what I would have done if I had been any sicker. Because, I mean, I was lucky. I didn't have to go into the hospital or anything like that. But it was the sickest I've ever been in my life. Mm-hmm. So, just throwing that out there. So we don't know what the next one's going to be, but if you have suggestions for episode topics, you can send them to us at rememberthatpod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Threads at RTTpod and also Instagram. I don't know why I said Threads first, because so many people are on there. But you can definitely find us on Instagram. And I guess you can find us on Facebook if you want. Social media is becoming less and less relevant, and I love that for us. We would love it if you would leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to this episode. And if you want to find me on the internet, I am at The Real Anna Webb.
And I'm at ACW Nerdfighter.
Whew, that's the most talking that I have done since the last time we recorded a podcast, so.
Bless. That's as much as I do. 6 times a day.
I know, but you're used to it. I'm not.
Yeah.
I sit here by myself. I had one call the week we were supposed to record, and the amount I was coughing in that, I literally texted Amanda afterward, and I was like, there's no way I'm recording a podcast this week. I had like a 10-minute call, and I couldn't get anything out. Yeah. So, like I say, hopefully next time I'll be better.
Yeah.
And... until next time,
remember that time.